You have to leave. That's mean.
And that's mean.
Mm-hmm. That is mean. It would be nice if there were a, like, don't record me option, but I still want to be in the meeting.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Well, you know, talk to Zoom about it. Well, folks, good morning. We are at February 28th, 2023. And next Tuesday, I will not be here Tuesday morning. I have not yet asked one of my friends, Ann or Debbie, to run the class. So they're, I'm going to ask them to duke it out to decide who. But I'll email you guys because I have another date I want covered. So maybe you guys can sort of split them up if you like. Thank you. yeah, next week is my wife's birthday, and we're going to go down to Pacific Grove, one of our favorite spots. Maybe go see some whales. Although I still will be doing the Living Kindness class Tuesday afternoon. So the whales will have to wait for that. We will send loving kindness to the whales. So, well, if anybody's watching this recording, it'll be interesting to see what they're like, what's going on? What's he talking about? Whales. So, yeah, let's start with some meditation. Welcome, everybody, from near and far. So, yeah, the topic for today is about calm and concentration. So maybe we'll, I don't know that we can do anything special to bring that about, but maybe paying a little extra attention to just letting the body settle. I think that's actually the first thing that really helps us to get more concentrated. So just beginning by establishing your posture, whether it's sitting or lying down. Could also do walking if you wanted to do walking meditation. I think most people are either sitting or lying down. And then coming into stillness, establishing stillness. And when we try to be still, and actually pay attention to that, you might notice, first of all, just the way the body is moving already with the breath. But probably more importantly, noticing any kind of restlessness or tendency to want to keep correcting the way you're sitting, trying to make it just a little more comfortable. And so at a certain point, we kind of abandon those efforts and just accept how we're feeling, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then having a sense of releasing tension through the body. We do this, you know, in more obvious ways, like softening the belly or relaxing the jaw. Releasing the shoulders, There's also a kind of inner releasing. Call it more, almost energetic. Start to tune in to not so much inner tension, but just inner release. And feeling the movement of breath. And letting the movement of breath integrate with this release. In the mindfulness of breathing sutta, it says, we first establish mindfulness of the breath coming in and out, then mindfulness of the whole body with the breath, and then finally calming the whole body with the breath. Just maybe tuning into how this might work for you. Calming the body with the breath. Not sort of trying too hard to do that, but just sort of allowing that to happen. What we see as we calm the body with the breath is that our focus isn't too tight in on the breath. It's somewhat open so that we can feel the body. And yet we don't lose touch with the breath in that process. You might see this as a balancing between body and breath, or you might see it as a more open, spacious awareness that contains both breath and body, whichever point of view really works for you. Clearly, an element of this process is persistently returning to the breath when the mind wanders. This takes a certain kind of determination. Often requires patience if the mind is particularly busy or just keeps pulling us away. there can be the tendency, temptation to get frustrated, trying to make concentration happen. Of course, this kind of attitude only creates more disturbance in the mind. So, thus, patience with the process. This is very much a case of staying engaged in the process, not focused on the goal. Another important element of this process is bringing kindness or gentleness in as a kind of guiding principle or perspective. If we have a kind of judgmental attitude or striving, aggressive, all of these, each of these is also disturbing and so counterproductive. They work to create less concentration, not more. When there is kindness, inherent forgiveness to our lack of concentration or our lack of perfection, and that attitude really blends well with the effort to bring calm. Kindness is a partner with calm. Gentleness. So as I said, we'll take up the topic of calm and concentration today. And I'm going to read a bit from The Burning Desire, from the step seven, page 197. But I guess I'll read this first. Concentration, it's a really, it's a challenging topic because it's kind of the number one thing that people want from meditation. And I think in the beginning of practice, people don't even realize that that's what they want because they don't maybe know that it's called that. And it's not just stopping thinking. That's a simplistic way of thinking of it. There is that element of the mind becoming quieter, for sure, in what we call samadhi. Our thoughts are a useful part of our practice. And our relationship to our thoughts, certainly a topic that we get into a fair amount here. But I really see what we call concentration as having much more of a physical element. So maybe there's the other word, samadhi is the one we usually translate as concentration. Then the other word is shamatha, which is more like calm. So maybe those two kind of blur together a little bit. In any case, I'm going to read a bit and then talk some more. When people ask me about how I work the steps, I often tell them that I use meditation as a gateway into each step. One of the most obvious ways that this works is in step seven. Almost every time I meditate, I let go. Mindfulness, of course, is one way this happens. Calm and concentration are another. Many times I've sat down in a state of agitation, anxiety, or resentment, and found as I follow the breath and become more focused that those feelings simply dissolve. I don't have to figure them out, write inventory about them, or otherwise deal with them. Just let the higher power of concentration melt them away. This is a wonderful tool for a person in recovery to develop, especially in early sobriety, but also later on as well. Many of us alcoholics and addicts seem to react to life with more stress than others. So having a reliable tool for dealing with that edginess and craving on a daily basis is precious. In the suttas, it says that concentration cools the passions, and in this way helps us to let go of clinging because we don't feel so driven when we are calm. A craving or resentment that seemed so important just dissolves under the soothing qualities of relaxing and stilling the mind. The fact that quieting the mind helps you let go of disturbances is commonly understood, as when someone tells you, breathe when you're upset. It's not that you aren't breathing, but rather that if you focus on a relaxing breath, calming the mind and body, the disturbance will often pass on its own. While it's true that just a moment of calming breath can help us to let go, the most beneficial effects of concentration come with concerted effort. When people first start to practice meditation, they often find it difficult and frustrating trying to hold the mind still. Unfortunately, for most of us, just setting aside a few minutes a day for meditation doesn't give the opportunity for the more effective levels of concentration to develop. That's the province of retreat. The essential elements of concentration are quiet, stillness, and repetition. A silent retreat with alternating periods of sitting and walking meditation gives us all three. The transition from daily life to the retreat environment can be difficult. We're so used to being able to change the channel figuratively or literally. When I went on my first retreat, I imagined that I'd be accessing all sorts of bliss states and peacefulness. But instead, my knees hurt, my mind wouldn't stay still, and I kept falling asleep. It was as though I thought that in going out to a meditation center in the desert, I would be leaving myself behind in Los Angeles. But of course, I came along with all my physical and mental issues. Coming into a real state of meditative concentration for the first time is like breaking through some invisible membrane. Inside the membrane is your usual noisy self, but when it pops, you open into something spacious and still. Some thoughts may still be there, but they aren't taking up all the space. They're just part of a much larger landscape. Until you break through that membrane, meditation can be fairly frustrating. Of course, I had this experience when I got sober, so maybe a sober person wouldn't feel that frustration so much. I had this experience before I got sober, so maybe a sober person wouldn't feel that frustration so much. But I do know that there is a qualitative difference to the experience of the concentrated mind. Once we have broken that membrane, it becomes easier to access concentration going forward. There will still be times when you can't get there because of the agitation in your heart, mind, and body. But when the conditions are ripe again, you will slip into it like a familiar and comfortable old shirt. One thing that makes concentration difficult is that it requires discipline. And this is a quality many people struggle with. People seem to associate discipline with negative images, like abusive nuns with rulers or drill sergeants breathing down your neck. However, I've come to see it differently. The word discipline is related to the word disciple, someone who is devoted to a teacher or a practice. I like to think of myself as a disciple or a devotee of my meditation practice. I do it because I love and honor it. I show up out of respect and faith in the process. I also see it as a third step. Even when I don't feel like it, I know the value of practice, so I turn myself over to that process. Concentration is probably the most powerful raw tool of the mind. While it can't permanently remove our shortcomings in the way that insight can, it's critical both in developing insight and in maintaining a peaceful heart and mind. So that's kind of one take on this topic. It's such a really vast topic, and there's a lot more that we can say about it. My own formula has changed a bit, so that in here I said that the elements of concentration were what? Quiet, stillness, and repetition. So nowadays I say instead silence, stillness, and time. So repetition and time are kind of the pointing to the same thing. Repetition is an important part, though, the repetition being the coming back to the object, you know, and that's the sort of essential instruction that's typically given to develop concentration. A few other reflections on this. From the sort of technical standpoint, there are two qualities called vitaka and vichara in the suttas that are kind of seen as foundation elements for developing concentration, and they are words that are like a lot of Pali terms that are somewhat debated somewhat, but the general understanding that most people have and is that they mean what Upandita, the Burmese teacher, calls aiming and sustaining. So that we begin by aiming, or the attention putting the attention on the object, right? Which the breath, and if you're using the breath as your meditation. So the first thing you do is like, okay, let me go feel the breath. That's the aiming. And then sustaining, you try to stay with it. So keep with it. And, you know, that's okay. It's sort of obvious in a way. Then there's another term which I can never pronounce, but it's something like I can't even say it, but it's EKO, and then it's like GATA something. I'll find it. It means one-pointedness, just staying with the object. So that's more than just sustaining. It's making the focus very narrow and just pointing one-pointedness. And that's the work. That's the idea that I think in English, the word concentration implies. And I think it's where a lot of us lose the thread on how to practice meditation, as opposed to like, really, you know, I'm just going to focus on this thing. That most of the time that doesn't work very well. And I have a couple of quotes that I'm going to bring in. And this is material from the book that I'm working on right now. On the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. I'll just read this section. I'll contextualize it a little bit. This is from the section in the sutta that says to bring mindfulness to the whole body. Analio is this Buddhist monk who one of my key kind of reference points in this book. Analio uses this step to discuss something that has been key to my practice for many decades. The difference between a tight, focused awareness on a single object, so one-pointedness, and a more open, spacious awareness. He suggests doing a kind of blending of these things, which seems right. Here we do take a particular object as our primary focus, in this case, the breath. But in so doing, we don't try to block out the rest of our experience, but rather have what I call foreground and background objects. The breath is in the foreground. The body and other objects, sounds, emotions, thoughts, are in the background. He points out something I have long noticed but have never heard discussed about tight awareness. This is a quote. The tunnel view that results from such exclusive focus makes it difficult to notice when a diversion is about to lead to a displacement of attention. Unquote. It's as though we were guarding the front door with such determination and focus that we didn't notice someone sneaking in the back. Tan Jeff makes the same point. Quote, when you're focused on one point and blot out everything else, that leaves a lot of blind spots in the mind. So this is what I would call the subtle art of concentration. You know, the unsubtle art of concentration is the just keep coming back, just hold your attention on this object. The subtle art is to have the mind be open. And, you know, so sometimes this is called choiceless awareness, where this isn't quite choiceless awareness, but choiceless awareness is the idea that you're just trying to pay attention to whatever shows up. So you have to keep an open awareness because you won't catch things that grab your attention or that where your mind is going if your awareness isn't open. I'll go on a little bit more. Nonetheless, Analio says this more open awareness is more superficial and imprecise. Unquote. That's superficial and imprecise, is a quote. So our concentration won't be as deep. I would suggest that in the opening stages of a meditative session, we can use the softer focus until things settle. When we feel quiet surrounding us, we can start to focus more precisely because those other diversions are gone, so they won't be sort of sneaking up. If we try to force a tight concentration, it just leads to more tension and struggle, which I was saying during the guided meditation, as we seesaw from focused attention to being lost in thoughts, meanwhile getting frustrated and judging ourselves. Such striving goes against the basic principles of Buddhist teachings, leading to dukkha in a classic way. Let me read one more paragraph here. Maybe even more. I want to emphasize this point so that it doesn't get lost in this lengthy exploration of Anapanasati. How we apply our attention, whether with intense focus or open awareness, is probably the most determinative factor on whether our meditation is pleasant and productive or not. The most common mistake people make in their understanding of the goal of practice is to believe that they are supposed to stop thinking. This mistake commonly leads to overly strong effort, which results in the pattern of striving, struggle, and resulting dukkha. The challenge, though, is to come to understand, to sense, and to adopt this open awareness. It is much easier to understand an instruction that says, pay attention to the breath, than one that says, let your awareness be open and spacious. Open and spacious is subtle to the point of being meaningless until you have experienced it. Thus, it usually takes beginners a fair amount of time and even a full meditation retreat before they can get a feeling for what this means. Analia uses a similar image as I do of foreground and background. Quote, it is as if breath and whole body have exchanged places in the field of our awareness. At first, the breath was right in front and the whole body in the background. Now the breath steps back, as it were, and the whole body steps forward. Since the whole body is a broader object than the breath, its coming to the forefront in the field of our attention naturally encourages a broad form of awareness. Unquote. This last point is important. When we say to broaden or open your awareness, that instruction can be confusing. How do I do that? Here we can see that simply by trying to feel the whole body, awareness expands. The same can be said of working with sound, which I recommend when wanting to expand awareness. Sounds come from a wide realm of space, and paying attention to sound thus means the mind must be open to that space. Analia uses another good image to illustrate these two different perspectives. When looking at a picture, we move close to see details and back to see the whole image. He correlates this with the closeness of the first two steps of the Anapanasati, feeling the long and short breath versus the third step of feeling the whole body. So there are some, I hope, helpful perspectives. I mean, it's sort of, you know, very technical in a way, I suppose. I mean, and as I say, you know, we're trying to put words to these very subtle experiences, but you know, I want to keep pointing at these things because I think that if you haven't sort of connected with this kind of practice, it's something to kind of keep in mind and kind of look for it in a way. Again, not striving, but sort of like have in your mind, like, oh, okay, I'm trying to get this different sort of open perspective, and kind of feeling your way around your own mind to try to find that. And there are, I mean, this is just a couple of sort of thoughts about this. I think I'll talk a little bit about another. I think this is sort of a different. Another sort of not a different approach, but sort of different perspective, which is not just that we are So I think this is related. It's not so just that we are like right now. I've been describing this kind of awareness of space, or awareness of an open, or having an open awareness. There's another way to connect with this, which is almost being more intentionally receptive. So this means having the feeling of like, whatever is coming, let me fully feel whatever is coming, whatever is here right now. Let me let all that come. And so this is somewhat of an energetic approach. Like, what am, and you know, and you hear me talk a lot about being present with your feelings. So we could say this is very much in that realm. What am I feeling right now? And that can have an emotional element, but it's not just emotional, energetic or felt, kind of the subtle body, they call it, feeling the subtle energies in the body. And when you get to the next stage of the Anapanasati Sutta, the first thing they're asking you to pay attention to is the subtle energy in the body called piti, or rapture. And sorry, there was somebody got thrown out of the meeting. So here we're tuning in, not so much to the breath or even the density of the body, but the subtlety, the subtle energies. And as I say, kind of almost like inviting them, like, ooh, what's here? You know, what can I really let in? There's a combination of a feeling of letting go, but also of receiving. And so I think of, as I say, receptive, a quality of receptivity. And I think to move into that space, there, the first thing we notice is the lack of receptivity, or kind of like, oh, I'm sitting here, but there's kind of a subtle tension that I'm just like, oh, I'm meditating right now, but I don't want to like feel everything that's going on, because it's kind of scary. I mean, it is. It's opening to your mind. It's opening to the fullness of your mind body experience. And in some ways, we don't necessarily want to be with all that. So it takes a certain amount of trust in kind of the power of mindfulness to hold all that. But this then receptivity and allowing, then it isn't so much what I would call a concentration practice, but it's very much a calming, because it's like a softening that allows things to settle. So again, I think our the subtle tension we often hold kind of doesn't allow everything in the body and the mind to just drop and settle. So just being very open, soft, receptive, and trusting. Okay, just let it come in. Let me just feel this fully and be with it fully. Just another sort of subtle, one of these subtle strategies, and they are really strategies, they're very intentional ways of being, of settling the mind and body. So that's a bunch of stuff, and I'll stop there and see if there are any reflections or responses, any questions, any confusion. Steve, hi.
Thank you, Kevin. A couple of things. What you're talking about, the feelings, and the part in the book and the reading was about, I'm very passionate about my practice right now, and have been for some time. And I'm going to have to embark upon an adventure today that so I'm having a lot of feelings. The feeling I'm having now is in the pit of my stomach. I feel like this nervousness because I have a friend that I've known for 53 years, and I've been like a father figure to this man who actually tried to commit suicide last week. Yeah. And I had mentioned that to you. And what's helping me right now, and I'm bringing this up to this community because I'm kind of in an emotional state right now, but reading all of your books and knowing that you've been through depression, they had a meeting last night. He's under 24-hour suicide watch. He's in the hospital. He jumped in front of a truck, and thank God the truck swerved to miss him, and he plowed into him pretty badly. Mm-hmm. And his two brothers met with the psychiatrist, and he's under a class 3 state of depression, which is pretty severe. And I know you understand that. And the teachings and the studying that I've done, I hope will prepare me for what I need to do, because I'm the only one that he wants to see. Other than his two brothers. Right. And I'm the only one that has the mental the ability to take this on. Right. And I have to be very careful because of my own addictions and my own tendency to be codependent.
Right.
So I can't thank you enough and all of the people here, because this is, I don't want to see him die, and he just can't seem to pull himself out of this. And, so I have to go. I'm going to go see him today and see what I can do. And I don't want to take up too much time, but I'm just here to say that thank you for the teachings, because I feel confident that I'm ready to do this and I'll be able to handle it and manage it. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Steve. I'm really sorry to hear about your friend. And you know, in those situations that are, they're impossible situations, right? That when we're asked to come and be with someone in these kind of places, and first of all, it's an incredible gift, right? That someone trusts us, you know, that we're the one that they trust, and you know, to appreciate that and what that says about you, and then. My experience is just be there. You're not, there's
that's all
nothing
I can do.
Yeah. And it's really, it's actually the best thing. Cause it's not like, oh, I'm going to go in there and say something and like some, you know, I'm going to pour out some emotion for him. That's going to somehow, no, but your presence is love, you know? It's just that's, you don't have to do anything more than just be that presence and be able to, because as you're suggesting, there's not many people who can be with that, you know, and so when someone's in that kind of state, they're very alone because people are afraid to be around that energy. It's overwhelming for most people. And so to be able to have the strength, the equanimity within yourself to just sit and allow it and be with it, that's the biggest gift you can have. And then afterwards, take care of yourself, you know.
Thank
be
you.
Kind I, to yourself that's afterwards.
That's what right? I'm going to do. I'm so grateful to all of these classes and the teachings and the studying and everything I've done to prepare me for this. And I don't know why this has happened all of a sudden right now, but maybe it's, I don't know, some divinity working in here or the Dharma. I don't know. Thank you for the support and the love to all of you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. Sean, hello.
Hello, Kevin. Thank you so much. And the feed is open to my feedback. I really just said, I've been on the receiving end. I've never been in that position.
I'm having trouble. Sean, I'm having trouble like hearing you clearly. It's just
can you hear me now?
I can hear you, yeah.
I know the best.
Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Kevin. And yeah, my heart goes out to the last person who shared. I'm not going to target share. My heart goes out to that. I just had a couple things real quick I wanted to share about, like, the getting to those concentration states. And I've never been on retreat, and it might show even by the way I carry myself, you know, but it did remind me of, I'll be honest, you know, because this is being spoken about more in Buddhist circles, but it reminded me of certain psychedelic states I had when I was younger, where you had to break through to get to a certain point where there was concentrated mental states. And, you know, and I'm a person in recovery now, but the other thing I wanted to say about that, you know, kind of comically, was I remember an old sponsor of mine saying that popping sound is the sound of your head coming out of your own ass, you know?
There you go.
Or it's a common statement. And the last thing I'll mention is just that the open awareness, that the kind of doing that dance reminds me of Qigong in a way, and more tranquil Qigong, like receptive awareness, and but being concentrated, being with the breath, and it not being the moving type of Qigong. But yeah, I'll share the time. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, Qigong is very much working with the energy that I was talking about at the end there. Yeah, it's more and even more intentional than that, than what I was describing, but it's the same thing. It is that subtle energy, chi, if you will. Yeah. John, hello.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for your sharing and guided meditation today. Appreciate it. So I have kind of a technical question. I've just started meditating. And what I'm doing is, because I've discovered that if I dive into something, you know, neck deep water, I end up drowning. And so I'm doing it in like, so I started off at like 5 minutes. That's my meditation. And so I'm adding a minute each week, the idea of extending it. But what you read kind of intrigued me and also made me a little anxious. It's like, well, you should go to a retreat. You know? Right. I'm like, oh, come on, man. I can't sit for, you know, 48 hours. So yeah. I'm curious, you know, if you could expand on that a little bit, maybe quell my anxiety, which probably is impossible anyways, but, you know, to go from 5 minutes to a weekend retreat would be a bit extreme. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah. Good question, John. I do maybe tend to aim a little high with this, but particularly, I mean, one of the reasons I talk about that right away is to lower expectations people have about what should happen in a shorter period of meditation, so that you understand, like, when you read this book that describes this, how meditation should be, or some blissful thing or whatever, that really what they're talking about, something that takes a lot more work to get there than just an ordinary 5 minutes. But that doesn't mean that starting with 5 minutes isn't a good approach. I think it's very wise. And I think your sense of like, oh, I tend to like overdo things or jump in too much, and then you'll burn yourself out, or like be like, oh, forget it. You know, it's like, all right, I'm going to run a marathon. So today I'll start with 10 miles. And then it's like, no, like take it. Yeah. So I think that's very wise, and just build up. When you're ready, go on a retreat. It's not as big a deal as it sounds, you know. It's definitely intimidating in our mind, like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to be quiet and meditate all this time. But when you're on a group retreat, you're in a community of people who are working together. You know, I went to a talk yesterday about a new book about awe. And a lot of, and the author, Dacher Keltner, pretty well-known psychologist and researcher around positive psychology and stuff, was talking a lot about started particularly talking about the way we, our minds and bodies actually sync up when we're together. And it very much made me think about how on a meditation retreat, there's this energy, and it's not like you're not alone with it. You know, you're sitting with it. It's like, you know, to do it like, okay, just meditate at home for 48 hours. No, like that's, you know, you're not going to just step into that. So I would just say, you know, trust in the process, and yeah, go at the pace that feels comfortable to you. But also don't limit your idea of what your own capacity is. You know, you certainly can build up to that. And if you hang out in these circles long enough, at a certain point, you're going to get curious and also kind of desirous of getting, you know, want, as they say in AA, I want what you have, right? It's like, you're going to be like, I guess if I want what you have, I'm going to have to, what do they say? You know, do what you do or something like that. You know, that's not the right phrase, but there's an expression in there. And yeah, at a certain point, you'll be ready and you'll know when, you know. I try to make my retreats a little more accessible for people in recovery so that they aren't entirely silent. We have a meeting at the end of the day, and we do some interactive workshop stuff where you work with a partner during the day as well. Because I know it is hard to take that step into like, oh, I'm going to go on this retreat. It scared me when I first, it still scares me because you're going to be with your own mind, but yeah, it's definitely worth working toward, but please. Yeah. I can't tell you what to feel, but I hope you won't get caught too much in the, you know, anxiety. I'm not sure what the anxiety is, the feeling like you're not doing it right, or the feeling like you're supposed to be different, you know. It's great that you're showing up. I mean, you're meditating for 20 minutes with us, so that's right there. It's not 5 minutes. It's a lot. Yeah, thanks, John. Thank you. Bill, hi.
Hey, Kevin, what's doing? Thanks again for the great class. It was something that I've been wanting to do a little bit more of, the concentration efforts on things. But it's interesting that you brought up that choiceless awareness, because I've been meditating for quite a few years now, but how you're open to almost anything that arises. And I'm finding myself in the beginning of meditations just kind of paying attention to the breath like we all do and all that. And then next thing you know, I'm just kind of like off on this thing of whatever happens, and just be with it. And it's just, and I think it happened kind of all of a sudden. I've been on several retreats, and I don't think anything compares to like that sixth meditation of the day on the fourth day of the retreat. Right. You're going into these spaces that are just unbelievable that I actually cherish. Yeah. I'm kind of curious on, there's a deep concentration going on there. Are those considered jhanas, or is this something different?
Yeah, jhanas are very specific states that there are certain sort of markers and elements that have to come together, because jhanas are actually altered states. Mm. So they're not ordinary states of concentration.
Okay. Yeah.
If you want to understand more about them, Lee Brazington's book called Right Concentration, that depicts one system. One of the problems with jhanas, so for people who aren't familiar with this word, it's J-H-A-N-A, and it's typically translated as meditative absorption. And there's a lot of debate in the Buddhist world about what constitutes a jhana. what's the purpose of a jhana? How do you get to a jhana? Do I need to have a jhana? And it's so messy that I don't talk about them very much anymore.
Yeah, but it was just more of an interest in it, just wondering what it was all about.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. What is it all about?
I work with my recovery Dharma group a lot with them, because a lot of them aren't real meditators at all. And I'll begin a meditation like with maybe Thich Nhat Hanh's, you know, the in out deep slow. And I'll go through that maybe 5 or 6 times in a row. And it seems like people get into a space because they always comment on it.
Yeah.
Just even using a counting meditation just for the concentration end of it. So Thanks, Kevin. I really appreciate all your insights.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's a really good practice, the Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, I love it.
Present moment, wonderful moment practice. Yeah. And Monica.
I was very, hello, everybody. I was very excited you were reading about, you know, I'm stuck on awe, thinking about what awe, when awe comes.
I'm going to find that book actually right now for people because it's really interesting. Yeah.
No, I think it's really fascinating and lots of good things coming through here. The one thing I can say to people who are just starting meditation, it is a little daunting. But I just stuck around. I just kept showing up and it, little by little and working with a meditation teacher, you know, that's all come. But I wanted to also, I'm not dealing with, you know, having to be there for a suicidal friend, but my mother is in a nursing home. She's 97. Mm. And it is a very difficult atmosphere because everybody's waiting. This is the last roundup for them. And, I without the meditation practice, I don't know where I would have been.
Yeah.
So, but it's very difficult. And I always think about it when I'm there, about how the Buddha, he wasn't yet, you know, had not become an ascetic yet, but he saw all this suffering, this death and dying, the wheel of samsara, and it always struck, I get to see it almost every time I go, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Monica, and I think that is seeing the Dharma and remembering that it's the Dharma rather than, oh my God, you know, this is so horrible. It's like, you know, that to me is taking refuge. It's like, well, here it is, you know, here it is. This is exactly what the Buddha talked about.
Well, yes, and I think I'm accessing what that means, taking, you know, when things are difficult, I go sit more, you know, and and just like you're, you know, we've been talking about living kindness. It's also just, not only do we have to be, you know, that we have opportunities for living kindness for others, but for ourselves. Cause
yeah.
It's difficult. I've had a lot of guilt.
Yep.
And thank you for everything that I'm learning and learning to sit with and accessing, because, you know, without it, I just can't imagine where I'd be, or with recovery, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think your last point about, you know, for yourself is really important too. And why I said that to Steve about, like, okay, afterwards, be sure and take care of yourself, because it's very difficult for, you know, I mean, you go and you visit somebody who's suffering and you don't really want to feel sorry for yourself, because it's like, well, they're the ones having a hard time. But it is really hard to be with suffering. And so we have to take care of ourselves, because we can't be of service if we get overwhelmed. And that's why a lot of people can't show up.
And that's I'm sorry to take up more time, but here's I do have a question then. So I'm going through this, and then there's other people that want to tell me about what they're going through. And it's really hard to tell them, look, I suggest you go over here and see if you can get some support. But it becomes even more challenging as a question, you know, how do you handle it when other people will also want you to be compassionate for what they're going through and you're just overwhelmed? Yeah. You know?
Well, I recommend golf. Because when you go out and play golf, it just takes your mind away from all those things and everything gets just cleansed. It's very cleansing.
Well, my thing is skiing.
Exactly. Yeah. The same thing. Yeah. Exactly. Just get out on the slopes. Like, just that'll just wipe it all out. Right? No, I mean, kidding. But yeah, I mean, we have to I mean, it's a difficult question. Like, oh, am I going to shut the door on being of support for people? And when do I do that? I mean, certainly when people, if I feel that people are asking for more than I can give or more than is reasonable, you know, like I'm not, you know, they're whatever, you know, obviously I'm in a role where I'm helping people, but I do protect that time and energy. I'm not like limitless in terms of my willingness to help people. I can only, you know, help them to a certain extent, and always acknowledging like powerlessness too, you know, like I can't really fix you. You know, I can't, you know, if you're looking to me to solve your problems, I can't, let's talk, you know, I'll talk to you and we'll, you know, and I'll make some suggestions. But at the end of the day, you know, you are responsible for you and I can't get in there and, you know, fix your brain. You know, that's why, you know, equanimity, I just muted everybody because there was some background noise. So if you need to say something else, you need to unmute. But that's why equanimity, where it says, you know, what's the line for equanimity? All beings are the owners of their own karma. Their happiness or unhappiness is dependent upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them, you know. Then, you know, you remind yourself of that when you get entangled in someone's drama, like, oh, like, no matter how much I meditate for them, no matter how much I talk to them, no matter how much guidance I give them, no matter how much money I give them, you know, if it's our children, you know, how many institutions I send them to, that it's their karma that they have to work out, and I can't solve it. Even if I have some responsibility, like with your own children, you're still, ultimately, they have their own karma to work out. And you know.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for spending time with me on that. So.
Yeah, of course. So it's. It's nice. I like people just hang out. Like, okay, I'm just staying until Kevin stops. It's cool. I'm down with that. I wanted to actually just, but people are here. So, you know, Monica, I just wanted to mention in terms of what you're putting into the chat that the we should get rid of the discount from Shambhala. Because it's not available anymore. I just noticed that went into the chat, so letting people know. Maybe if Ann and Debbie want to hang out, we can talk about collective effervescence. That's right, Ann. Well, that's what I saw Docker yesterday. He did an event at Berkeley at Morrison Library. Jill Satterfield and I went and saw him. And unfortunately, the discussion got caught up in my favorite topic, plant medicine. As soon as it comes up, it's like John is like, oh, let's talk about that. I'm like, oh yeah. And there was a woman there with him who is like an indigenous scholar who has just written a piece about, for the Lancet, about basically Western people appropriating plant medicine in unethical ways and in ways that that avoid really embracing the full spiritual spectrum of it, of that, of those practices. It was really interesting. I actually can find that article if anybody is interested. I think I can find that article because I had it on my phone yesterday. So anybody, you know, this is like after class now. We should turn off the recording, I think.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, bye. Thanks.
Kevin, thank you so much for your support, and I will see you this afternoon at